when we speak next, because he is a legendary musician, composer, and performer. But he's kind of a, he is the musician's musician. He has been there or thereabouts. He has been hugely influential. He played with some of the greatest musicians, organized some of the greatest bands, concerts, and tours, including Joe Cocker's Mad Dogs and Englishmen, which has been quite something. And he's still standing, believe it or not. The book is called Leon Russell, The Master of Space and Time's Journey Through Rock and Roll History, which I love. And delighted to be joining me live from the States, the author of the book, A Journey Through Space and Time, and it's Bill Yanovitz. Bill, good afternoon from us. Good morning to you, sir.
Hello.
Good to have you with us. Whereabouts are you? Whereabouts do we find you on the planet today on this fine day in Spain? It looks like it's quite nice over there as well.
It's not so bad. It's Lexington, Massachusetts, right outside of Boston.
Very nice indeed. The people may not know about Leon Russell, but they certainly, he's got a look, hasn't he, to put it mildly, and the look hasn't changed. In fact, if anything, it's like a fine wine. It's matured over the years.
Yeah, absolutely. You're just talking about his appearance and the way he kind of...
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, he was sort of the icon for early 70s rockers, for sure. Long hair, long beard, mirrored shades, you know, groovy clothes.
Absolutely. And a singer-songwriter who's had a remarkable influence on, well, songwriters for the decades. I mean, he really goes back, what, to the early 60s and that sort of style of music, isn't it?
Yeah. He actually started as a teenager backing Jerry Lee Lewis in 59, but really came out to L.A. and started playing with all the people that later became known as the Wrecking Crew on Phil Spector, Frank Sinatra, you know, the Byrds, et cetera. So he learned songwriting back from some of the masters back then. And, by the late 60s, he was writing his own songs.
Cause that's one of the great things, isn't it? Because being in Jerry Lee Lewis's sort of support band must have been a life changing experience. I mean, very few people probably would still be in therapy about that now, I'd imagine, to be honest with you, with the killer.
Yeah. I mean, never being an 17 year old kid. So, you know, I sent him on a certain trajectory from which he could not return.
And also the Wrecking Crew, because we kind of forget that, you know, back in the day there were session musicians, because you had your singer. They didn't come fully formed with the band, so they'd be playing with everybody. And if you look at I'll go back to the British situation here, you get people like you know, Jimmy Page, for example, playing on everybody, and Hendrix in the States playing on a lot of, you know, Wilson Pickett stuff as well. I mean, there's that house band who are playing all sorts of different styles, but getting the groove on it and learning some great music theory and playing as a band.
Yeah, I mean, Elton John came from that same scene as well. He had been backing R&B bands from the United States that came through. I mean, well, artists, I should say, that didn't come with bands. And he was playing with Long John Baldry, and he was playing sessions. So by the time he comes out and makes his debut in the States at the Troubadour, where... who was there? Leon Russell. So they were sort of on this similar trajectory. And it's no wonder that the two became, you know, sort of mentor and protege kind of thing.
So did he sort of set out to be, if you like, a star in his own right? Was he just chugging along in his own groove? Because obviously we go into that later 60s period where it gets very interesting. We get away from that clean cut sort of doo-wop or sort of label manufactured bands in the mainstream. And you start getting some really interesting singer-songwriters breaking through.
Yeah, absolutely. He was a real beneficiary of the singer-songwriter era, though he's not sort of, I mean, he did have these sort of ballads, and one of his best-known ones is A Song for You from his debut album, but he was kind of known as a rock and roller back then as well. It wasn't so much a Laurel Canyon navel-gazing sort of acoustic guy. It was a real driving, hard piano, even when he was sort of doing some ballads. There was some edge there. But yeah, he was a little reluctant, I think, at first. He was more than one person I talked to said he was a rock star before he was actually a rock star. He just had this quiet charisma, but he was sort of insecure. But it really took a few people, you know, building him up to say, look, you can do this. You can be a writer. You can be as good as Bob Dylan or the Stones or whatever else, you know?
I mean, where's he originally from? Because you're just talking about Laurel. When you say Laurel Canyon, I mean, you sort of think Southern Californians or some Canadians moving south to hang out with Joni Mitchell. So
That's exactly right. No, he came from Tulsa, Oklahoma, but he came to Hollywood as an 18-year-old to a 19-year-old and to sort of crack his way into sessions. And he thought he was just going to sort of, when he was that age, he just thought he was trying to get into advertising, basically writing jingles and things like that, playing on jingles. But his talent was so great that he became that first call session player, and then soon was putting together bands on TV, et cetera. And from that, one thing led to another. Delaney and Bonnie and Friends was one of the great bands that changed the path for so many artists like Clapton and George Harrison and Elton John and Joe Cocker. All those guys sort of heard the Stones. They all heard this record, and they're like, who's this guy playing piano? And it was right around the time that Mad Dogs and Englishmen, that tour with Joe Cocker, started. That was 1970.
Yeah, I mean, and let's think about a few things here, because when you say he was a bit of a rock and roller before he was a rock and roller, when we think Wild Man of Rock and giving it tons, it's normally the guy on the lead guitar, or he's got the screaming obscenity of a sax, or he's fitting into ridiculously tight pants like Robert Plant. So sort of at this point, I mean, you can say, okay, yeah, the Killer, you know, he was a rock and roller before they needed to be a rock and roller, Jerry Lee Lewis, Little Richard before that, all the same time. But, you know, keyboard players, they were supposed to be more kind of Emerson, Lake and Palmer playing with eight different keyboards at the same time, you know, and, you know, perhaps a small keyboard with their nostrils. I mean, so he really sort of was setting the scene for keyboard rock and rollers.
Yeah, absolutely. And when I say rock and roller, I mean, he was a star before he was actually a star, meaning that he would come into the room and people would be just struck by his presence and his quiet charisma. But yeah, he really did bring piano to the forefront. And it was during that Mad Dogs and Englishmen tour and subsequent film and album that you can see Leon taking over the stage. I mean, he's not only strutting around and stomping on his piano, but he's actually going out front with a guitar because, you know, you are trapped behind a piano when you're a piano player, unless you are Jerry Lee. Even Jerry Lee was sort of, he could pound the keyboard with his feet, but he was still at the keyboard, you know.
And I mean, to take some of the glory away from Cocker as well, because Cocker live on stage was the, you know, what we call in Spain, duende. I mean, he seems to be possessed with a divine spirit, to put it mildly.
Yeah, I used duende in this book to describe Leon's persona at his peak. Sort of rock stardom in the early 70s. But yeah, Joe Cocker was kind of a taciturn and troubled guy off stage, but on stage he was an absolute force to be reckoned with. And Leon had assembled this gigantic sprawling band with multiple drummers and multiple keyboardists and a choir for this tour, Mad Dogs and Englishmen, all backing Joe Cocker. And very few frontmen could command the presence still in the eye of that particular storm. But Joe did. Joe had a bellowing, big Ray Charles kind of esque voice, but with a little bit more of a rocker element to it. But yeah, and even within that storm, and even with a strong personality like Joe's at the front, Leon became sort of known as, it was sort of more Leon's band than anybody else's, and he was accused of sort of stage hogging a bit on that tour.
That also brings in another thought: the fact that if he's assembling a band and basically almost sort of conducting it from behind the keyboards, he knows his music theory. He knows how to put a band together. He's not a knuckle grinding sort of three chords and go home guy.
Right. I mean, nobody, I should say only musicians and people really paying attention to liner notes, maybe who knew who Leon Russell was at that point. But he had, that was sort of the tip of all the iceberg of all the work he had put in since 1959. Here we are 11 years later. He had already done millions of records. He had not only just played piano, but he was arranging big sessions back when that really meant something, you know, 32-piece orchestra, for example, for Gene Clark of the Byrds. I mean, big productions. So, and that quiet charisma, he didn't need to sort of yell at people or clap his hands or make a big deal. People were watching him. You could see that in the film. They're all kind of keeping their eye on Leon, and all he does is a little twirl of the hand or a blink of the eye, and the band stops on a dime.
So, you know, we talk about being, you know, people want him to work in their records. And I suppose if you want that sort of that big sound, and it's not with a producer per se, you're not asking for a Phil Spector like sort of creature behind the, and I use that word advisedly, behind the, you know, production in the production booth wall. But then he finds himself, you know, Elton John, obviously keyboard player, but also George Harrison. And, you know, Harrison, a lot of people sort of were brushing him off at the time as, before All Things Must Pass came out, as, well, he's just writing a couple of songs. But when you look at the depth and the technicality that Harrison was doing in those late Beatles stroke before All Things Must Pass, and the Bangladesh concerts.
Yeah, so George Harrison becomes enamored with like Clapton and like Elton with this piano work on Accept No Substitute, this album by Delaney and Bonnie and friends. And they become obsessed with that band to the point that Clapton actually takes the whole band and into the studio for his first solo debut album and becomes essentially Delaney Bramlett. You know, Eric takes that part and all those guys, you know, Jim Keltner, Jim Gordon, Bobby Whitlock, they all kind of go on to play on George Harrison's All Things Must Pass. Leon was a bit too busy for himself to play on it, but he gets George and Ringo, not to mention Bill Wyman, Charlie Watts, Steve Winwood, to play on his debut, Leon's debut. So all that stuff is sort of happening at the same time. Clapton takes a big portion of Delaney and Bonnie and Friends and the Mad Dogs and Englishmen band on and forms Derek and the Dominoes with them. So that's that. All of those guys come out of that scene, as do the horn section, who the Stones take, Jim Price and Bobby Keys. It's this great period of rock and roll. And yeah, then Harrison becomes very good friends with Leon and taps Leon to put together the band for a concert for Bangladesh, you know, along with some of George's friends like Badfinger, et cetera.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because they seem to be taking it in a way that they don't do today so much. And it's not like an industry person saying, well, you know, we're going to have you rapper with you singer and, you know, bring people in like that. It seems to be much more organic in those days. Like, okay, well, we'll borrow you guys and hey, do you want to play on my album? We'll play in Europe. And they cross over. I mean, I remember, you know, the Stones were doing that with the Faces and the Who and whatever else.
Yeah, it's this great scene. It's a mutual admiration society, really, you know, and the only thing standing in the way, and you see this with Leon's debut, is sort of a lack of actual credits in the liner notes, because they were tied to contracts for labels. And actually, that became a big deal with the Concert for Bangladesh album. It's like, which label got to put that album out? And it actually held it up a bit. But yeah, no, they were all... It's funny, you know, they all really respected each other, but sort of Leon is this through line from about 68 into 72 with all of those bands. I mean, at least three or four of those guys came from Tulsa themselves with Leon as high school kids, you know? So it was really, I don't think people understand how crucial and galvanizing a force he was.
Just, I mean, for people may or may not know this, I mean, we're talking about Joe Cocker. Was he one of the original, was he the original composer of Delta Lady then? Was Delta Lady a Leon composition?
Yeah, Joe didn't really write. I don't think Joe wrote any songs. On that second Cocker debut, I'm sorry, not the debut, on the second album that Cocker put together, there are two songs by Leon alongside one by Lennon and McCartney, one by Leonard Cohen. I mean, he's in an elite company, but Leon is the only guy with two on that record, and it's Delta Lady and Hello Little Friend.
Okay. So the other thing is, of course, we think piano players in the 70s, and you're thinking Elton John. Because obviously he had they would say, the technical chops, brilliant singer-songwriter. Bernie Taupin is doing, you know, his greatest work, in my honest and humble opinion. But, you know, technically Elton can't be, you know, is up there. And as a showman, nobody's going to touch him in that Dodgers outfit in the mid 70s. So what's the relationship between Leon and Elton John?
Yeah. I mean, and all of these people sort of lead to Billy Joel, for better or for worse, as well, and some other.
All roads lead to Billy Joel. That would be interesting family tree to do, wouldn't it? You know.
No, I mean, just piano taking, you know, piano front men and front women. I mean, there's also, we can't forget Carole King, great singer, songwriter who, you know, stayed at the piano, and Aretha Franklin, et cetera. But Elton, like I said, Elton was already sort of on a similar path as a very similar path, but just from over on the other side of the pond as Leon. But when he said to me, Elton did, I spoke to Mr. John, Sir Elton.
Sir to you. Thank you very much. Yeah, doffing of cap.
Yeah, he said he heard Leon playing piano on that Accept No Substitute album and said, this is everything I wanted to be in a piano player. It's got the roots, it's got the R&B, it's got the soul, it's got the pop, it's got a little classical influence. And then he sees Leon as this persona. So Elton makes his debut at the Troubadour, a very famous debut in L.A., spoke about in his own book and in the film Rocket Man. And he says he sees this figure, this intimidating rock star with the long hair and the mirrored shades and the beard, and he's only in the first or second row. Now, meanwhile, I mean, he's sort of intimidated, but meanwhile, Leon is like, well, this, now my career's over. Before it's really even started, because here's this guy that can do everything I can do, if not better, and with this showmanship, as you say. And they, I mean, Elton goes out and opens on tour for Leon. Leon's career skyrocketed after Mad Dogs. His debut, it became this huge thing, and he was playing arenas pretty much right out of the gate over the Fillmore East in New York. And so Elton goes out and opens up for Leon on that first tour and becomes Leon. And then, you know, Elton's career skyrockets, even accelerated greater than Leon's. And Leon eventually went the other way, and Elton, of course, went on to become giant Elton worldwide star. But it was really the influence of Leon, and he credits Leon to a great deal.
And not only that, there's a little bit of thing about, should we say, we talk about the both skyrocketing, perhaps the off stage enjoyments. I mean, they have as the Americans say, there are demons to contend with as well at certain points.
Yeah, I mean, neither of them were big drug guys at this era. You know, Leon had done his experimentation as others with, acid, of course. That changed that changed so many people's minds, literally in the mid 60s. But by the early 70s, I think he had been fooling around with some angel dust. He drank a little bit. He had gotten most of that stuff out of the way by the time his career got going. Meanwhile, Elton said to me, actually, that he didn't really start doing drugs until the Caribou sessions around that time. Oh, it was a little bit later. He was a serious musician and didn't want that stuff to get in the way.
So you say that his career, Leon Russell, if you say to most people, they won't kind of know, but as I said, musicians know him, but he hasn't disappeared without trace. There was an Elton John and Leo Russell collaboration. Now I'll say something like it's 5 years ago, and then it'll turn out to be about 15 years ago, because that's how time operates. But he's been, during the 80s and 90s, his star, he doesn't wane. He's still there, and also he's collaborating with. I mean, he's worked with the greats. He's worked with Sinatra from before, and as you know, he sort of rehabilitates Willie Nelson.
Well, I mean, he was a galvanizing force for Willie as well. I mean, Willie was trying to break out of that sort of straight Nashville scene. He moved to Austin, Texas. He started to let his hair grow out. As soon as he saw Leon, he really let his hair grow out. And he brings Leon in for what became the first of a series of annual picnics, the 4th of July picnics, these Willie Nelson big shows, where he brought together rock and rollers, singer-songwriters, and the old time country people and new country people. I mean, both of these guys, like most musicians, were musically omnivorous, and they loved all kinds of popular music. And they really didn't see the reason that country music people and rock and rollers, as they say, ropers and dopers, should be in independent silos. So the two of them started a lifelong friendship and collaboration. They collaborated on and off, starting from 1973 or so, putting out records in 79 and then later being on each other's records. Leon did sort of, he stayed on the road. He stayed, but he made a series of very bad decisions, plus some things that were out of his control, like a divorce and artistic choices that, while admirable, were alienated some of his fans. And he was really kind of, by the time Elton came back to sort of, in his estimation, in his characterization, to repay a debt, so to speak, Leon had kind of gone off in the wilderness and was playing really some small joints where, the stage was basically just a corner of carpet in a bar. He had gone from the biggest stages to the smallest, literally. And it really took Elton coming back to repay that debt he felt to Leon as a mentor.
So where does Leon stand at the moment? What's he up to, basically?
Oh, right now? No, he passed away in 2016.
No, I know that. I mean, what's somebody standing, as in the legend, the legend that is?
Oh, yeah. No, he was. Oh, well, no, now he's regarded, I think, highly. But he was, because Elton brought him and really lobbied hard. It was really Elton's efforts to get Leon into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Yeah. So that kind of helped cement his legacy a bit. But it was not long that after that Leon sort of jerked the car back into the ditch, and he was a stubborn curmudgeonly, sort of set in his ways type guy, an older guy. So he was sort of back to playing the clubs. His audience had sort of plateaued, and he was playing at least stabilized. I should use the word stabilized, because he had kind of gotten back to a certain level that befit his legacy, if not the biggest part. But yeah, then it got quiet again, I think, after. So that was, we're talking about 2010 when that record came out, The Union with Elton.
Blimey.
Yeah. For the last maybe 15 years, it's been quiet on the Leon front. So I hope this book brings him back, and I know it is bringing him back to public appreciation.
Yes, that was going to be presumably one of the aims. I mean, you said you've spoken to Sir Elton John, if he's not Lord by next week. Which other musicians were willing to speak to him and talk about the influence they have had on him?
Yeah, is that what you're asking me? Yeah,
how happy were they to talk about Leon? And you know,
I mean, he was one of the first people I got to talk to, and he was. It's in the book. It's like he called him his idol, and he said, you know, it wasn't just that he wanted to check off something on his to-do list. Oh, I need to make right with Leon. I mean, it wasn't like he did anything bad. It's just like he has sort of gone his own way, and he felt like, you know, there was a bit of a revelation starting around 2008. And there's, you know, the story about who these people that bring Leon's attention back to, I'm sorry, Elton's attention back to Leon, who brings it back into his eye. And he repays that debt, but he wants to kind of oversee Leon's career from 2010 and help him stay up there. But that's what I'm talking about. Leon has his own ways and sort of says, thanks, I really appreciate it, but I'm going to do my own thing. Mm.
So the book, I love the title, by the way. Absolutely brilliant. What do you hope that people take from it? And what should the budding, well, for somebody who, you know, if you were to do a Leon Russell 101, what direction would you point them in terms of, you know, songs to listen to or three tracks that will best describe? It's difficult for a guy who had a 60-year career, I know, but best describe what he was about.
Well, he wrote no fewer than three standards, four or five, really, if you look at it. But A Song for You became a giant song for Donny Hathaway and other people that have covered it. I mean, it's covered every year on American Idol. Then you've got This Masquerade, which was a gigantic hit for George Benson. It topped three charts, and number one on three charts in the United States. And he also wrote Superstar, which the Carpenters and even Luther Vandross covered, another big, huge song that he co-wrote, actually, with Rita Coolidge. It's hard to tease out the credits here. But I think people will love this book. Anybody that loves sort of the stories of rock and roll, especially during the golden era, and that's kind of the somewhat cumbersome subtitle of the book, you know, the Master of Space and Time.
I like that. That sums up that late 60s, early 70s sort of, hey, you know, Greg Allman's probably falling over behind the piano behind him sort of thing, you know?
Yeah. But I mean, here's a through line from the earliest-ish days, you know, for playing with Jerry Lee Lewis all the way until 2016. I mean, he kind of saw it all, and he was the guy. I mean, he was selling out arenas that the size of Led Zeppelin's tour. I mean, he was outgrossing Led Zeppelin back then. So it's incredible to know. And then it's like, where does he go? And that's kind of the story. But I think that people just love good human stories will love it, but particularly people that love classic rock.
The book is called Leon Russell, The Master of Space and Time's Journey Through Rock and Roll History. It's by Bill Yanovitz, who is speaking to you today. Bill, if people want to find you online, because I know you do other bits and pieces as well, where can they track you down in the nicest possible way?
Yeah, BillJanovitz.com, or find me on social media. There I am.
And the book will be available as a virtual download from our own virtual store. The book is called Leon Russell, The Master of Space and Time's Journey Through Rock and Roll History. It's by Bill Janowitz. We're going to play out with a song for you. Bill, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for giving me your space and time, so to speak.
Well, I see what you did there. Bill Janowitz, have a great day.
Places in my life and time, I've sung a lot of songs, I've made some bad rhymes, I've acted out my love in stages with 10,000 but we're alone now, and I'm singing this song to you. And I know your image of me is what I hope to be. I've treated you unkindly, but darling, can't you see? There's no one more important to me. Darling, can't you please see through me? 'Cause we're alone now, and I'm singing this song to you. You taught me precious secrets of the truth, withholding nothing. You came out in front, and I was hiding. But now I'm so much better, and if my words don't come together, listen to the melody, 'cause my love's in their hiding. I love you in a place where there's no space and time. I love you for my life, you are a friend of mine. And when my life is over, remember when we were together. We were alone, and I was singing this song to you.
Singing this song for you.